So, Shabbat. And when I came up with the idea that I wanted to do Shabbat as the fourth of our topics, you know, I knew I was going to have to narrow it down somewhat. Like, what aspect of Shabbat are you going to talk about? It's too big to do everything. So I chose the Shabbat meal, along with a little bit about Kiddush and Havdalah. You'll see how they all fit together. Take a look at source number 10, please. This is a passage in the Zohar on the Torah portion of Yitro. Of course, Yitro contains within it the Ten Commandments, right? Including number 4. Remember the day of Shabbat. There are called to mind the day of Shabbat is really a better translation of it, to make it holy. So take a look at this passage here. It's talking about what you accomplish at your meal, and it's based on a verse which I added in brackets, a verse in Isaiah, in Yeshaya. The verse, look at the bracketed part first, please. The verse itself. The verse says, when you observe Shabbat, then you will gain pleasure from God. I will place you atop the heights of the land. I will feed you the portion of your father, Jacob. The mouth of God has spoken. That's the verse. So the Zohar sees three components here. You will gain pleasure from God. I will place you atop the heights of the land. I will feed you the portion of your father, Jacob. Those are your three levels. So now let's look at the paragraph. Parallel to the three levels that are found in that verse, one must complete his meal, and one must enjoy all of his meals and rejoice in each one, which is the complete faith. There is an element of faith involved in the meals of Shabbat. I'm going to come back to what that means. When Rabbi Abba sat at his Shabbat meal, he rejoiced at each one. He would say, "This is the sacred meal of the ancient Holy One who is hidden from all." At the next meal, he would say, "This is the meal of the Holy Blessed One." And so at each meal, and he rejoiced at each one. When he completed his meals, he said, "The meals of faith are complete." When Rabbi Shimon came to his meal, he would say, "Prepare the meal of higher faith. Prepare the meal of the king." Now, because I translated the Aramaic into English, it's not going to sound familiar. But for some of you, it may sound familiar, oddly, in the Aramaic. Anyone ever hear a song sung traditionally, well, in the synagogue at Sudash Lishit at the third meal, but it actually has versions for all of the meals, Atkinu Seudata, or as it's usually sung, Askinu Seudasa, right? Like that? Okay, a few people recognize it. That's this passage. That's what I translated here. The meal, prepare the meal of higher faith. Atkinu seudata de mehemnuta. Mehemnuta like emunah. Prepare the meal of the king. Atkinu seudata de malka. So he would say, prepare the meal of higher faith, prepare the meal of the king, and he would sit and rejoice. When he completed the third meal, they would declare about him, "Then you will gain pleasure from God." That verse from Isaiah, "I will place you atop the heights of the land. I will feed you the portion of your father Jacob." In other words, there are three meals on Shabbat parallel to these three blessings. These are meals of faith. These are meals of joy. Okay. What in the world did that mean? Why would we call these meals of faith? What does that mean? Why would you call these meals of faith? Sorry? It's a day of rest. What does that have to do with faith?
Were you accepting God's command that you should do this?
Okay, you're accepting God's command to do this, but that's true for any mitzvah. Yes, Elaine.
Well, I was sort of going to say the same thing, but in order to keep Shabbat, you must. There are no logical explanations, though there may be some, but you truly have to have a Muna, like, to believe that this is what God wants of us.
Okay. And there certainly are many approaches that offer rational explanations for it, including the very popular idea of unplugging one day a week. I get a kick out of that every time I hear it. They talk about unplugging on the weekends. I'm like, yeah, I do that. I don't know if I'm any saner for it, but try. What is Shabbat about in the first place? What do we say in Kiddush? Zecher Yetziat Mitzrayim and Zecher Maaseh Bereishit. In Kiddush we say, yes, it's a day when we're supposed to halt our work and rest to commemorate getting out of Egypt, and really earlier, commemorating creation of the world. These are meals of faith. Faith in the idea that the world is created by God. Faith in God's ongoing supervision of the world such that he took us out of Egypt. That's your faith element to it, but there's so much more. And here we get to something which people say, but I don't think that we often think about what it means. You ever hear the phrase, Shabbos Malka or Shabbat HaMalka? Right? You've heard that phrase. What does it mean? The Sabbath Queen. What does that mean? Esther. That's interesting. One queen, queen. Okay. Sorry? Then an angel? Sorry? The Shekhinah? Okay. But what does that have to do with the Shekhinah is supposed to be an aspect of God or manifestation of God. Ethi, what were you saying?
That the Shabbat is on top of more than anything else.
That Shabbat is somehow above, is royal. That was perfect. We're going to come back to that. We're coming back to that in a minute. But first I just wanted to show you, it's not a made-up thing that Shabbat has a royal aspect to it. Sometimes it's a king and sometimes it's a queen. But take a look at source number 11. The Talmud in Shabbat, that's the volume of Talmud, is called Shabbat. Rabbi Chanina would wrap himself and rise at the eve of Shabbat, saying, come, let us go out to greet the Shabbat queen.
Sorry? The woman in the house who lights the Shabbat candles.
No, we don't get to be royalty. We have a quasi... I shouldn't say that entirely. Before we're done, we'll see that we do. There is an aspect of it for us also. We'll get there. But Rabbi Chanina puts on his finery and says, let's go out and greet the Shabbat queen. In fact, there's a song that's sung traditionally as part of the liturgy Friday night, Lecha Dodi, written by Rabbi Shlomo Alevi Al-Kabetz. And at the end of it, you're supposed to turn, either some people turn to the entrance to the synagogue, some people will turn to the west, but you say, bo'i kala, right? Come in, O bride. But in the Sfard, in the Sfard edition, they say, bo'i Shabbat Malkita, come in, Shabbat Queen. That's straight out of this. That's straight out of number 11. That's what Rabbi Chanina was doing. As a matter of fact, we have a practice of having three meals on Shabbat. That's traced back to the fact that the Torah says with the mitzvah of the man, when God tells them to prepare the man on Friday to eat on Shabbat, so he says, eat it today three times. So therefore we have three meals on Shabbat. But there's also a practice of having a meal when Shabbat ends. What's that meal called? Malava Malka, escorting the king. Right? There's some debate as to how to say this. Meaning, depends on whether it's Aramaic or Hebrew. If it's Hebrew, then it's queen. Malka Mem Lamed Kaf He. If it's Aramaic, then it's Mem Lamed Kaf Aleph, and it's king. Most people assume it is queen. That's fine. We're not going there. But take a look at source number 12.
Yeah. Three meals.
The Friday night, Shabbat lunch, and Shabbat afternoon. Well, it can be breakfast. I mean, it depends, right? During the winter time, when Shabbat is so short, my preferred thing to do is to get up early and go to the early minyan at 7:30. Come home, you're home between 9:30 and 10, and at that point have my second meal, you know, of the day. In that way, I can have another meal at 3:00, 3:30, whatever it is, and not feel stuffed. You know, to eat a proper meal. In the summertime, on the other hand, why would I do that? I have a long afternoon. It depends. You vary. You vary your schedule. That's what I do anyway.
But when you get up and you have like your little breakfast, that's not considered a meal.
Right. So I don't eat before services. I know the Hasidim do. I'm not saying that nobody can. Hasidim do. They'll have cake. Saying that they can't talk to God properly on an empty stomach. They need to focus. Some people need that. I'm not getting into a discussion of Jewish law on what you can and can't do. But the thing is, you're going to require kiddush. In other words, having this meal, it requires kiddush. It requires that you have the two. It's not just the coffee somebody drinks. So The Aruch HaShulchan, Rabbi Chiel Michel Epstein, wrote the following in source number 12 regarding this Malava Malka meal. He says, the reason for this meal, the meal at the close of Shabbat, as Rambam wrote, is to honor Shabbat at its entrance and its exit. Right? We have Kiddush when we start Shabbat, and then you have a meal at the end of Shabbat. Meaning, it is like escorting the king with the honor of a meal. Therefore, this meal is called escorting the queen. He doesn't care about king, queen, that's not an issue for him. That's melaveh, is to escort. So, like a levaya is the term for a funeral. It's escorting the dead. Or escorting the mourner, perhaps. No, it's escorting the dead. So to here, it's escorting out Shabbat, which is why also the ideal way to do that meal is to do it nicely. As opposed to, you know, you're sitting around later on and working at your computer and you take a sandwich. Like that's not really the way it's supposed to work. It's supposed to be you do a nice meal to escort out Shabbat. There's a song that's popular on Friday night meals, Mayididut or Mayididus, right? It starts out, Mayididut Menuchatech at Shabbat Hamalka. It talks about Shabbat as the queen. But here's my question to you. And this goes back to something that Etty said before. When I say royalty to you, what adjectives come to mind?
Stately.
Stately, okay.
Majestic.
Powerful.
Opulent,
sumptuous, wealthy, dominant, right? That's what we think of when we think royalty. The Kabbalah says that's not what royalty is. You're looking at it wrong. And it looks at it in a much deeper way. And it turns the idea of Shabbat as royalty on its head. And thereby teaches us lessons about Judaism and life. And this really blew my mind. I said, okay, now I know why I did this series, just to learn this idea. You'll hear it and you'll understand what I'm saying. It's true. What really is royalty? How does royalty gain power? Not how does it gain power. And where does the power of a king, a queen, where does that power come from?
They're appointed.
They're appointed. I mean, you can become one by conquering something. You can become one by inheriting. But the question is, where does the power originate?
The adoration of the people.
The masses.
The masses.
Popular? No, a king, a regular king. Popular acceptance. The power that, I'm not talking about God being the one who appoints kings. The power that a king has fundamentally, the power that royalty has, is popular acclaim. Right? Look at England. Right? You only have, as a monarch, you only have the power that the people choose to give you. That's it. Where does the king's wealth come from? The people, right? The people earn it, and they pay the king taxes. The army goes out and conquers something and brings back wealth. Predecessors hoarded money and left it to the current king, the current queen. The king doesn't produce anything. What is the king supposed to do with that wealth? Supposed to do? Distribute it to the people. Right? It's supposed to be used for defense, it's supposed to be used for roads, it's supposed to be used for the welfare of the nation. The king does not use the wealth personally, the king distributes it to the kingdom. In other words, the king is a vessel. The king is a pipe. The king receives and distributes. And that is how Kabbalah portrays what it calls malchut. Monarchy. We've mentioned before that there are sefirot. Sefirot are supposed to be the emanations, the ways in which God influences our world. The last, the bottom of the sefirot is called malchut. The last one is malchut. It means monarchy. And here I could have gone looking for sources and translating and making the sheet a lot longer. But I found actually a quick paragraph on, of all places, Chabad.org, that actually said exactly what I wanted to say. So I apologize. I don't usually cut and paste from a site like that. But in this case, it just said exactly what I wanted to say. So I swallow my pride and cut and paste from Moshe Miller in source number 13. He says, on one hand, Malchut receives all that it has from the other sefirot, these other emanations, and is described in Kabbalah as, quote, having nothing of her own. Thus, the Zohar compares Malchut to the moon, which has no light of her own. Right? The moon just reflects the light of the sun. On the other hand, Malchut is the final revelation of the divine light for which the entire process began. It's the last of the Sefirot, that bridge that brings God's emanations to this world. It was for the purpose of Malchut that all the Sefirot were emanated in order to send that light to this world. Thus, Malchut is both the receiver and the consummation of giving. It's just the pipeline via which all of the benefit is communicated. That's the way Kabbalah looks at it. Take a look at Numbers 14. Striking line from the Zohar. This is talking about a verse in Zechariah, the prophet Zechariah, in which he describes the Messiah as Ani Rochev al Hachamor, a pauper riding on a donkey. You've heard of the idea of the Messiah's donkey, right? He's described as a pauper riding on a donkey, and the Zohar can't understand it. He's a king. What do you mean, a pauper? What is that about? So the Zohar writes, Zechariah 9 calls the Messiah a pauper, but should the king Messiah be called a pauper? Rabbi Shimon said thus, because he has nothing of his own, and we call him King Messiah, we give him that status of being a king, but he has nothing of his own. And also, this is the sacred moon above, like we just referenced in 13, which has no light other than from the sun. It simply receives. One more, number 15. Sarah was called a queen. Sarah, the wife of Abraham. Her name means a noble. Sar is a noble. Sarah is the feminine version of it. She is a queen. And it talks about, in this passage, I didn't bring you the entire passage, it talks about how Sarah is taken to Pharaoh's palace and comes away without any of his influence. She's taken to Abimelech, the Philistine king's palace, and again, leaves, and nothing of that sticks to her. Why? Because she has Malchut, this trait in which nothing sticks to the king. Everything just passes through. They're not themselves. They rather, the royalty ultimately serves. Now let's take that back to Shabbat. On a very down-to-earth level, right, it is a day that commemorates God as creator of all. It trusts God, that's that faith that we talked about, to send that blessing. God didn't do any malacha on Shabbat. He stopped creating for Shabbat. We don't engage in any malacha, in creative actions on Shabbat. There's nothing, you're not doing anything. And in that sense, on a very simple level, it has this attribute of royalty. You're not producing. That's on a very straightforward level. That's without any mysticism. But on a mystical level, even more so. I brought you source number 16, which is going to be unintelligible by design. It talks about the first paragraph of the Kiddush on Friday night. The first paragraph of the Kiddush quotes the Torah's description of God halting and blessing the Sabbath day. The beginning of the second chapter of Bereshit of Genesis, which has 35 words in it. How do I know that? The Zohar told me. I didn't double check. 35 words in it. So it says here, the sanctity of Friday night, right, this Kiddush you are doing, the sanctification, is the sanctity of Shabbat of Bereshit, of Genesis, that first Sabbath, which was sanctified from 32 paths of Binah. Binah is the divine influence sent to Malchut, to royalty, and three levels of the sacred apples. We're not discussing the sacred apples. And for that sanctity, we must state the deeds of Bereshit. My point in bringing it is only to say, the 32 plus 3, 35, they're seeing within the opening paragraph of Kiddush this idea of the sanctity that flows to Malchut. But what we will understand is the brilliance of source number 17. Source number 17 blew me away because I never thought about this at all before. And once you see the question, you're like, huh, yeah, you're right. Tell me something. How did the Jews receive food when they were in the wilderness?
Man.
The man. Right? Not money, manna. Two different things. They had the manna. Fell from the heavens. How often did it fall? Once a day, every day. You got up in the morning and you found it, right? Except on Shabbat? No. It didn't fall at all. On Friday, a double portion fell. We commemorate that by having two loaves of bread at each of our Shabbat meals, right? But you don't have to eat both. You just have two loaves there. You can. But they are commemorating what happened on Friday. On Shabbat, no manna falls. So the Zohar asks a question that is so simple that I look at it and wonder, why did I never think of this? Take a look at source number 17. It quotes that verse of the mitzvah of Shabbat. Call to mind the day of Shabbat to sanctify it. Zohar Yom HaShabbat L'Kadosho. Rabbi Yitzchak said, Bereshit 2, verse 3, right, Genesis 2, 3, says, and God blessed the seventh day. And regarding the manna, Shmot, Exodus 16:26 says, you shall gather it for 6 days, there will be none on Shabbat. If no food is found on that day, what blessing is found there? You bless the Shabbat day by giving it nothing. You follow?
Yeah.
The day of blessing has no blessing. Yeah, I never thought of that. You know, but it was in the Zohar all along. They didn't teach us the Zohar in kindergarten. So what do? They have to learn it at some point. But he says, but we have learned thus. All blessings above and below, meaning in the heavens and on earth, depend on the seventh day. And we have learned, why was manna not found on the seventh day? Because all of the higher 6 days are blessed from that day. Meaning, when you observe Shabbat, that gives blessing for Sunday through Friday that follow. And each one provides food to the day below it, each on its day, from that blessing which is received on the seventh day. Therefore, one who is on the level of faith, right, again, going back to the faith that's demonstrated by having a Shabbat meal, by making Kiddush, must set his table, prepare his meal for the nighttime meal of Shabbat. You prepare beforehand so that his table will be blessed for all of those 6 days. For at that time, on Shabbat, the blessing for all 6 days of the week comes, and blessing is not found on an empty table. That's a basic principle in the Talmud, that blessing is not found on that which is empty. You have to provide something. You have to do something. You can't just say to God, give me. You got to do something. So you set the table, and that invites in the divine blessing. And it continues to say, therefore one must set his table for the night of Shabbat with bread and food. It even goes on to say, make sure your table is never empty on Shabbat. There should always be something on the table for this blessing. So that's the mystical aspect of Shabbat as royalty. It has no blessing of its own. It's receiving from the preparation you did on Friday, and God is now sending it for the rest of the week. And it's distributing. That's malchut. That is monarchy. The focus is a focus of faith. The focus is on God. The focus is not on what we are doing. We're just the recipients of the good who channel the good to others. And that's why I say, you're right, that to a certain extent, we are also royalty in this. Because we are also not taking. We are also transmitting. And the last source I brought you here in number 18, similar idea, going back to the joy that we mentioned. We said that you have to have joy at these meals. He says, therefore, one must take pleasure these 3 times, for these are interdependent with the higher faith. What does that mean? What does that mean? These are interdependent with the higher faith. One depends on the other. What does that mean? Because faith generates joy. If you can bring yourself to believe God created this, God provides for it, God is supervising it, then you lose your worries. I'm just receiving from God. That's it. And therefore you're able to rejoice in the meal. This is not easy. This is not child's play. To have that kind of that kind of faith, but that's what we're talking about as the core of what Shabbat is supposed to be. These meals are meals of emunah, of faith. Judith. Yes. Yeah. No, I think that's an accurate read. I think that's an accurate read. So we emphasize God at Havdalah also. The Zohar has another piece on this. I was ODing on Zohar. I didn't bring it on the sheet. But the Zohar in Parshat Vayakhel says that at Havdalah also, when you recite Havdalah, this prayer at the close of Shabbat, it's a recognition that as you enter the week, there are other forces that are empowered in the world. There are other forces that God allows to hold sway, to do things in this world. But when you recognize that everything comes from God, and that's that malchut idea again, the recognition that the blessings we receive are all coming from God to be distributed, then you're associating with God instead of whatever powers are given the ability to function in this world. So with our Shabbat meals, when we set the table for Shabbat, we effectively are providing for the week. And now I want to go back over the series as a whole. I don't know how much time I have because I had to restart the thing. Oh, wow, I got 10 minutes. This is awesome. I should forget my notes more often. The idea here in general, overall, with our series, right? We gain perspective on what mysticism believes the universe is all about, right? Going back to the origin, you know, when we talked about kashrut, right? And we asked the question, so what do our mitzvot accomplish? And we talked about how Kabbalah says it's more than just a check mark. It's more than God told you to do and now you've done. But rather, it's you're having an impact on the way the universe functions, on God's influence being sent into this world. That's coming about through you, the wiring behind the wall, as we discussed, and the decision of what to eat and what not to eat actually involves forces that are involved in those creatures. So we said some of the creatures are from the side of generosity and mercy, and some of the creatures are associated with judgment, and that kashrut, according to this idea within mysticism, is about attaching ourselves to the traits of generosity and mercy, as opposed to attaching ourselves to the traits of judgment. That was our first session. We moved from that into the discussion of Torah study, and we talked about the idea that we are meant to repair the world, not only the very practical tikkun olam type of projects that people do, but on a mystical level, we are making this world capable of receiving divine influence. And we accomplish that on different levels with speech, thought, and deed. And we talked about the importance of speech as a means of repair, as opposed to destruction, can be both, and how speech that is dedicated to God with the study of Torah in particular has that quality of repair. That brought us to mezuzah, and the idea that we invite God into an area, into a space. And we discussed that in the beginning today, how the mezuzah is involved in consecrating space for God, making the home, in fact, like an altar, as we did with the Pesach offering. And then finally, this issue of Shabbat, how you're taking time and identifying time as space, identifying time as as royal, time, this specific unit of time, as a time when God will send blessing, because we prepared in advance for it, we set the table, God will then send blessing for the rest of the week, as long as we dedicate our meals as expressions of that faith in God who created everything and who sends who sends that influence. Was that clear? That's an accident. Okay. Questions then? We have a couple of minutes. Yes?
I have two questions.
All right.
Number one, about the mezuzah. I understand that everybody lives maybe in big homes and lots of rooms, but years ago, when you lived in one room, you had a mezuzah on the front door. Why isn't that sufficient?
Right. So it's a good question. So first, I would contest the idea that people lived in one-room houses always. Right. And this is a really important point having nothing to do with mezuzah. This comes up in a lot of different areas of Judaism. We can't confuse Poland with Jewish history. By which I mean, there's an awful lot of stuff that we picked up in Eastern Europe, starting, call it, in the 15th century, that's inexact, and, you know, running until the Holocaust. But that wasn't there beforehand. You know, and I say it regarding homes, recognizing Jews have lived in many types of homes over the ages. You can go far enough back and, you know, Avram and Sarah have their tents. I don't know how many rooms you get in a tent. I've never lived in it. I mean, I've lived in a tent, but not those kind of tents. But at the same time, we find biblically the idea of a person having their own room, their own cheder. So it's not as though Jews were always living, you know.
But even in Egypt, when we say the blood was posted on the doorpost, maybe that was where the mezuzahs were.
Well, see, there, I'll counter that, because at the plague of the frogs, God describes through Moshe where the frogs are going to go. And he says they're going to go uva chadar mishkavcha, and in the room where you lie down, suggesting that you have multiple rooms. Now mind you, he's speaking to Pharaoh. So yeah, Pharaoh's got multiple rooms. But I think he's speaking about it for Egypt as a whole also. We can go back and forth, but the bottom line in answer to your question of how do we know that it's for all the rooms is simply because the Torah says it, and you can actually see it because it's on the sheet. If you go back to source number 8, the last line, on the doorposts, plural, of your house and in your gates. So the Hebrew, mezuzot beitecha, right? It's taken as all the doorposts again, unless the room has something in it that's inappropriate for a mezuzah. Incidentally, just because I commented on it before, in general, for questions about which rooms need a mezuzah, ask your rabbi, please. Ask a competent authority in Jewish law. Mezuzah questions with modern architecture become complicated because we don't construct our doorposts necessarily in the way that they did. We don't have our entrances in the rooms the way that they did. Open plan. All these things create a lot of confusion. I would never answer questions when I was a shul rabbi. I would never answer questions about a mezuzah without seeing it, if I could at all avoid it, because you have to really see it in order to understand it. Okay, there were a bunch of hands. You had a second question still.
All right. I probably think everybody wants to know about the sacred apples.
The sacred apples. So I will tell you what I can say, but I can't say much because I'm not a mystic and I haven't studied it in depth. The idea of apples as being special is something found in Shir HaShirim, in Song of Songs. The fragrant apple has a special relationship for the Jews and God. Tachat ha-tapuach o-ratich. God is described as awakening our mother, the Jewish people, beneath the apple. There you were birthed. Shama chiblat chaimecha. There your mother birthed you. That's the Christian idea of the apple in Eden. It's a Christian idea. It's not ours. The Torah never says ever that it was an apple. It's based in part on that verse. Because the word in the Hebrew that says, there your mother birthed you, is shama chiblatcha imecha. Chevle leida are birth pangs. However, what else could it mean, lechabel? To destroy or to corrupt. And they took it as, there your mother corrupted you, and it's Eve, and therefore the tree is an apple tree. That coupled with their belief that Latin was a sacred language. And what is the term in Latin for an apple? Oh, come on. What kind of acid is associated with apples? No. Malic. Malic, M-A-L-I-C. The word for an apple is malus, M-A-L-U-S. And of course the prefix for bad in Latin is mal. So it's a linguistic thing, plus this verse in Song of Songs that convinced them that the tree must have been apple. We never, ever, ever had this idea. The Talmud and the Midrash have four different suggestions for what the fruit in Eden could have been, ranging from the etrog to the grape, to the fig, to wheat. All of which has its own reason. Not so. Sorry. I'm going to use the last 2 minutes for this one because this is a favorite rant of mine. The question of apples in the Middle East. Historians in the first part of the 20th century believed, as they had believed for quite some time, that tapuach, when it appears biblically, does not mean apple because they said, going back thousands of years, there were no apples in the Middle East. That was their argument. And so they suggested that tapuach can actually mean some round fruit, because tapuach in of itself can mean something that is bloated, something that is round, and in fact we use that. Orange in Hebrew, tapuach zahav, right? Golden apple, shortened to tapuz. A potato, Hebrew, tapuach adama, pomme de terre, right? Same idea. That's what they thought. And they thought that all those Jews who thought tapuach was an apple biblically were just fooling themselves. Until the 1950s, when archaeologists discovered fragrant apple orchards that had been destroyed by the Romans. We absolutely had fragrant apples going back a couple of thousand years. It's just they disappeared for a while. But no, tapuach does seem, in fact, to be apple, and particularly the fragrant apple found in Shir Hashirim in Song of Songs. There's much more to say about apples and all of this, but we're going to call it a day. And remember, I sent out the flyer. You can already register if you want. The series in May will be Leading Anti-Semites, of History's Leading Anti-Semites.